This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, dozens more die of COVID, but you'd be forgiven for thinking the end of the pandemic is in sight as Australia's two most populous states wind back COVID rules. Also, a regional community left reeling on news that Australia's largest coal-fired power plant will close within a few years.
The amount of renewables that is coming into the market, which I think has caught all of us by surprise at that speed, has made the viability of coal-fired power stations quite challenging.
All of the people that work at that power station live in and around that community. Those people have no jobs.
And Donald Trump is toying with a return to the US presidency. We'll look at the damage he's done to democracy and lessons for Australians contemplating their vote this year.
When I've talked to Australians in the past and people around the world, that they often say to me is, why is it that, you know, the choices we have are just awful? Think about, what can you do to get involved in local politics? How can you press your local political party to recruit people who eventually will become the national politicians and so on? It's up to us.
Welcome to the program. On a day that has seen 63 more people die from COVID-19, the two most populous Australian states, Victoria and New South Wales, have announced a major easing of restrictions. But there are some nerves among epidemiologists who agree this is not the end of the pandemic. And as the East Coast relaxes, numbers are climbing in Western Australia. 177 new locally acquired cases were recorded today, up from 115 yesterday. Oliver Gordon reports.
More than 2 years in, Melburnians like Louisa feel like the end of the pandemic is finally in sight.
It's getting close because now it's better. All is open, the people are free, walking.
How does it feel to be getting close to the end, in your opinion?
That is awesome, amazing. Has been a hard time, so now it's okay, finally.
It looks like it, but I still stay. We still have another 4 or 5 months to go.
And the Victorian government's going to ease some restrictions from tomorrow, density limits. Do you think that's a good thing?
Everything helps. Every bit helps. I mean, business people would be happy with that. So it's a good thing, yes.
From Friday, restrictions will ease in Victoria and New South Wales. In Victoria, density limits in restaurants and cafes will go, indoor dance floors will reopen, and you won't need to scan a QR code to enter a shop. Premier Daniel Andrews says there could soon be changes to indoor mask mandates and work-from-home orders.
We look forward to being back here before next Friday, confirming those arrangements as well.
In New South Wales, Premier Perrottet has gone even further. As well as scrapping density limits, from Friday, QR codes will only need to be scanned before entering nightclubs and music festivals. And work-from-home orders will be at employers' discretion. Premier Perrottet has also set a date for the end of widespread mask mandates.
From next Friday, the 25th of February, the following adjustments will also be made. Masks will only be mandated on public transport, planes and indoors at airports, hospitals, aged and disability care facilities, correction facilities, and indoor music festivals with more than 1,000 people.
The easing of restrictions comes on a day when 63 people were reported to have died from COVID-19 across Australia. It's this fact that has some experts scratching their heads. University of Melbourne professor Nancy Baxter says it's too soon to ease indoor mask rules.
Because that will really drive transmission. So we may not see another spike, but what we're going to see is that, you know, the cases kind of stop coming down and we have a plateau, like we did in Victoria when we opened up the last time at a high level.
The epidemiologist says removing masks will also make it harder for those in the shadow lockdown to come back into the world.
People just aren't going out because they're afraid of getting it. And the best thing you can do to get people out of the shadow lockdown is really to get cases down. And relaxing masks won't do that.
But epidemiologist Tony Blakely has a different view. He's not of the belief, like those who we spoke to on the street, that the pandemic is over.
No, there's still water to go under the bridge.
But he says, all things considered, now is a good time to start easing restrictions.
Yes, I think it's time. We're going into a phase at the moment where we don't have a variant other than Omicron around. Hopefully we'll have a good few months, maybe even longer here. We've been up to the tabletop mountain and we've managed to keep that tabletop mountain of infection rates not too high by flattening the curve. We've gone a lot across the plateau at the top, and now we're coming down the ridge. And as we're coming down the ridge, we can release or loosen off those restrictions. And it's time to loosen off things like masks and open plan workspace and density limits. That will perhaps make our descent off the tabletop mountain a little bit slower. We might just plateau there for a little while, but we will keep coming down and get down to the valley floor in 6 or 8 weeks, something like that.
The epidemiologist says high rates of Omicron in many communities could have long-term benefits for society's immunity.
We think that probably about half of the population is going to be infected with Omicron. And what that does is, alongside of or on top of all the vaccinations we've had, is going to make us more resilient for whatever comes next. So whatever variant comes at us next, we'll have a more diverse immunity portfolio, if you like, as a population. We will not get to herd immunity. That's gone with this virus. It's too infectious for that. But we'll get to a situation where we're reasonably resilient, and that's where we're getting to now.
Back in Melbourne, food delivery driver Louisa says she's ready for things in the hospitality industry to get back to normal.
That's perfect for all of us, for the restaurant, for me working as a Uber driver, so that's fine for all of us.
Are you still scared of COVID?
Not really. No, not really.
Melbourne food delivery driver Louisa, Oliver Gordon, our reporter. Well, the Federal Court has heard today that Victoria Cross recipient Ben Roberts-Smith once threatened to, quote, put a bullet in the back of the head of one of his comrades if his performance didn't improve. The serving SAS member gave evidence that the incident left him feeling his life was in danger while serving in Afghanistan, not only because of the Taliban, but also because of a bullying Mr. Roberts-Smith. Our reporter Samantha Donovan is following the defamation trial Mr. Robert Smith is running against three newspapers. I asked her about today's evidence.
Linda, the court calls this witness person one, and he's given evidence that Ben Robert Smith bullied him from 2006 to 2013 while they were serving together in the SAS. The threat to his life, he told the court, was made by Mr. Robert Smith after a mission to Chora in Afghanistan in 2006, when Mr. Robert Smith had been angry person one hadn't shot at a young Afghan who he'd spotted from a mountain observation post. And person one agreed that he'd also made the very basic and serious mistake of forgetting the oil for his gun, which Mr. Robert Smith's lawyers say put lives at risk. Now, person one told the court that Mr. Robert Smith told him that if his performance didn't improve on the next patrol, he was going to get a bullet in the back of the head. Person one said this made him fear for his own safety, and he not only had to worry about the Taliban after that, but had to look behind him at his own people. He then reported the verbal threat to troop headquarters, he told the court, and that, he said, led to Mr. Robert Smith again threatening him, standing over him, looking down on him, saying, if you're going to make accusations expletive, you'd better have some sort of proof. There was another verbal threat several years later, person one told the court, when the troop was getting ready for a mission and Mr. Robert Smith pushed him in the chest and said, get out of my way, expletive, or I'll kill you. So the court heard from person one that the bullying and undermining of his skills by Mr. Robert Smith started early in his SAS training, and he believed the soldier had a negative attitude to him because he'd come from the Army Reserve and not the regular Army. As an example, he said Mr. Robert Smith slapped him across the back of the head on 2 or 3 occasions when he hit something during vehicle training. At the end of that training, he said Mr. Robert Smith told him he didn't have the skills or ability to deploy to Afghanistan, and he was going to do everything he could to have him removed from the team. And there were some other incidents, Linda, that person one told the court about, where Mr. Robert Smith would spit on the ground as he walked past and slam doors in his face. And he also said the more experienced soldier told others he was incompetent and a coward.
So how did the soldier say he was affected by this alleged bullying?
Well, he told the court that while he believed being in the SAS was the best job in the world, he hadn't been able to enjoy it in the years. He says he was bullied by Mr. Robert Smith. His confidence had been affected, he said, and he had years of worry, lost sleep, and his progression up the ranks had been slowed. Linda, in his defamation case, this case against the three newspapers, Mr. Robert Smith is challenging their reporting of him as a bully. And in his evidence to the court last year, he specifically denied bullying person one. The court heard lengthy details of Person One's performance reviews over several years today, which indicated that as soon as he was no longer in Ben Robert Smith's troop, his performance improved dramatically. In the end, the court heard Person One was deployed to Afghanistan 7 times, and he's now a sergeant and a parachuting instructor at a Defence Force school. The trial continues tomorrow, Linda.
Samantha Donovan reporting there. Well, the death knell continues to toll for coal-fired power stations, with the owners of Australia's largest facility announcing they'll shut it earlier than planned. The Eraring Power Station is near Newcastle in New South Wales. It'll now close by 2025 as renewables like wind, solar and hydro increasingly make coal-fired power unviable. Nick Grimm reports.
Coal has long been the bedrock of power creation in this country, both the stuff that heats, cools and lights up our homes, and the kind that gets governments elected and tossed out. But increasingly, the market has been determining that's changing as more and more renewables come online and the fossil fuel loses its commercial advantage. Tony Phillips is the site manager for Eraring Power Station.
The amount of renewables that is coming into the market, which I think has caught all of us by surprise at that speed, has made the viability of coal-fired power stations quite challenging. So that's led us to the decision to provide the 3.5 years' notice of a proposed exit.
Eraring's owner, Origin Energy, is seeking approval to close the facility near Lake Macquarie by 2025, 7 years ahead of its previously planned retirement date.
We all know that the transition to net zero emissions means that there will be an exit of coal-fired power stations over time. And that's important that we support our people with that exit and, do everything we can to redeploy, reskill, provide those opportunities when we decide, make that final decision to close.
We were shocked and surprised. We were actually blindsided. We found out this morning of the announcement through the media, so that came as a big shock to us.
That's Robin Williams from the Mining and Energy Division of Union, the CFMMEU. He warns the closure will have a massive impact.
All of the people that work at that power station live in and around that community. It'll be one of those issues that would potentially decimate a community. Those people have no jobs, and a large majority of them, like I said, live in that area.
The Hunter's retiring Federal MP, Labor's Joel Fitzgibbon, has told the ABC the new closure date will be problematic for workers.
We had a plan, a transition plan for many of them, but this is all interfering now with that schedule, and people will be hurt by this decision.
And the staunch defender of his electorate's coal industry warns it will mean higher energy prices and less reliable supply.
This is now a real problem. We have a number of baseload power stations exiting the system early. It's going to put upward pressure on power prices, and it could disrupt the energy supply. And the reality is policy initiatives that cause Australian coal-fired generators to close, say, a few years earlier than the planned end to their physical and financial lives will do zero in reducing global emissions, but they are now costing us dearly at home.
And the response from Federal Energy Minister Angus Taylor, bitterly disappointing, he said, also pointing to what he sees as the likelihood of higher prices and supply shortages. But the New South Wales government insists it's taking steps to ensure that won't be the case, announcing plans to build the biggest battery storage facility in the Southern Hemisphere. The 700 megawatt transmission battery will be located at the Eraring site, generating both jobs and a crucial backup supply to the grid. State Treasurer Matt Keane.
The battery will act as a shock absorber to free up more capacity in the system to ensure that users can access more of our existing supply in the system.
And advocates of renewable energy argue there's plenty of time to prepare for coal-fired power station closures. The Climate Council's Dr. Madeleine Taylor lectures in energy law at Macquarie University.
7 years is actually more than enough time, I would argue, to transition this coal community away from coal and into more sustaining jobs that are more commercially viable for them and their families, and also to welcome large-scale battery storage to replace the amount of coal, of course, that will be removed from the grid because of this.
The Climate Council's Dr. Madeleine Taylor speaking with Nick Grimm. Well, a patient in New York has become the first woman in the world to be cured of HIV. She's been free of the virus for more than a year after receiving a stem cell transplant. It'll fuel the hopes of the 35,000 Australians living with HIV, though a cure for them is still a good way off. Isabel Musali reports.
Infectious disease specialist Dr. Marshall Glesby was excited to share the news. The first woman in the world to be cured of HIV, and the third person in history.
It's particularly notable because she's the first woman who's achieved a long-term remission of HIV, and it's particularly important because worldwide women constitute over half of people living with HIV.
The patient with leukemia received a stem cell transplant from a donor who had a resistance to HIV. The woman had the procedure in the US some time ago, but in the last 14 months, she's stopped her HIV treatment.
Well, I'm quite optimistic. In addition to just monitoring for appearance of HIV in her bloodstream, there have been a number of other research evaluations that have been done, primarily on blood samples, to look at the so-called HIV reservoir, where HIV is hiding in the body. And thus far, those tests have really not shown evidence of any active HIV at this point.
So how significant is this? Professor Sharon Lewin is from Australia's Doherty Institute and is the president-elect of the International AIDS Society.
Well, this is the third case of a cure for HIV following bone marrow transplantation. And it is exciting for the field because it's proof that a cure is possible for HIV. But we always are a bit cautious in this setting because this kind of intervention, a bone marrow transplant, would not be appropriate for people living with HIV. This woman received a bone marrow transplant because she also had a blood cancer that needed to be treated.
Kirby Institute Director Tony Kelleher also has a word of caution.
So, look, I think it's a very significant proof of principle. It's yet another demonstration that this can be done, but it's not a widely applicable observation or therapy. So the problem with bone marrow transplantation is that it's a very good therapy if you're very sick with a leukemia or a lymphoma. This sort of transplantation for this condition has a mortality associated with it of about 20%.
So if this isn't the answer to the average person who has HIV, are there other research projects underway that might provide a more realistic cure?
So there are a number of approaches on a research basis being looked at for this. And what this case demonstrates is that this is a possibility, and so that it is plausible that other approaches will also succeed. And so those approaches vary from trying to wake the virus up in its reservoir and kill the cells, through to various approaches of gene therapy where we're trying to lock the virus down.
But he warns they're still some way off. And while a cure would be better than treatment, Adrian Ogier says people with HIV today can live long lives. He's from the National Association of People with HIV Australia.
We currently have a really good smorgasbord of HIV treatments that are available to be taken daily. Generally is one pill with a combination of treatments. They're really well tolerated. They can actually control HIV in the body. They are great for long-term health, have little side effects, and above all, they actually can prevent somebody from passing HIV on to a sexual partner.
Adrian Ogier from the National Association of People with HIV Australia. Isabel Musali with that report. You're listening to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. And up next for you, a Trump date. Yes, the presidency of Donald Trump may be in the rearview mirror, but the aftermath of his chaotic leadership and his attempts to subvert democracy is all pervasive in the United States. It's at the heart of persistent cultural and political divisions there. We haven't been bringing you daily updates on his utterances, nor of the often shocking revelations from the committee that's looking into the January 6th attack on the Capitol. But Donald Trump's hold on the Republican Party is very tight, and he is unofficially campaigning to become president again. So tonight we'll bring you an up-to-date look at the damage he's done to democratic institutions in the United States and the lessons for safeguarding Australia's democracy. Shortly, my interview with author Brian Klass, who sees the risk of more violence because Trump supporters are convinced that any election won by the Democrats would be rigged. He's also worried about the type of people who seek political power and why we are drawn to people who are clearly bad leaders. But first, here's David Sparks with a few of the latest scandals and controversies.
There's more than 2 years until the next presidential election, but a dancing Donald Trump wants everyone to know who should be leading the country, and he's promising big things for his supporters.
If I run and if I win, we will treat those people from January 6th fairly. We will treat them fairly. And if it requires pardons, we will give them pardons because they are being treated so unfairly.
Anyone who thought Donald Trump would fade away after losing the presidency has been proven wrong. The news about him never ends, and it constantly throws up new surprises.
Staff members at the White House residence discovered wads of printed paper in a clogged toilet and believed that former President Trump was trying to flush documents.
Accusations that Donald Trump mishandled documents while in office and just after he was booted out emerged last week.
And there are new questions about whether classified information was mishandled.
And as he deals with negative publicity, Donald Trump is furious about what he says is the media's failure to cover damaging news about Hillary Clinton. While he was in power, the Trump administration appointed a special counsel, John Durham, to investigate possible misconduct during the probe into Russian interference in the 2016 election. On Friday, Mr. Durham lodged a court filing accusing a lawyer for the Democrats of sharing with the CIA in 2017 internet data that supposedly showed Russian-made phones were being used in the vicinity of the White House. Donald Trump has seized upon the accusation, and so have his supporters at Fox News.
This is police state stuff.
I'm getting a little excited. So Donald Trump put out a statement yesterday saying that this is worse than Watergate and there should be criminal proceedings. And then he had a line where he said, in a stronger moment or a stronger time in our country, what did he say? This could be met with the death penalty or something like that.
But Donald Trump has another problem, and this one's not going away. New York's Attorney General Letitia James is investigating whether the Trump family inflated real estate values to obtain bank loans and also reduced values to lower tax bills. A New York state court is due to hear arguments on whether subpoenas should be used to force Donald Trump and two of his children to testify. The former president has dismissed the investigation as a politically motivated witch hunt. And as for his ambitions to win the Republican nomination for the next election, few in the party are arguing with him. But one powerful Republican pushing back against Mr. Trump's claim that the last election was stolen from him is the party's leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, who is scathing of the January 6 riots on Capitol Hill.
It was a violent insurrection for the purpose of trying to prevent the peaceful transfer of power after a legitimately certified election.
Even Donald Trump's former Vice President, Mike Pence, rejects claims of a stolen election, and he has again slammed the idea that as Vice President, he should have overturned Joe Biden's victory.
President Trump is wrong. I had no right to overturn the election. The presidency belongs to the American people and the American people alone. And frankly, there is no idea more un-American than the notion that any one person could choose the American president.
The former US Vice President Mike Pence, that report by David Sparks. Well, Associate Professor Brian Klass is an expert on democracy, authoritarianism and US politics at University College London, and he recently published a book called Corruptible: Who Gets Power and How It Changes Us. We spoke first about Donald Trump's attacks on democratic institutions.
Well, he hollowed out democracy over the course of, you know, basically 5-6 years, because he started doing it in 2015 when he violated norms as part of his presidential campaign. Remember that he didn't release tax returns and other things that were expected of presidential candidates in the United States. So the sort of norm erosion around democracy in the United States predates when he actually won and became president. But then when he became president, he continually took a wrecking ball to democratic institutions in the United States and changed how they functioned and changed the Republican Party as well. You know, I think the thing that's frustrating about it as somebody who studies the breakdown of democracy is this wasn't unexpected. It wasn't out of the blue. It was something that had been simmering for a very long time. And, you know, it's of no surprise to imagine that if there was a situation in which Trump had to choose between preserving his self-interest, preserving his sort of self-myth, and preserving democratic institutions, we all knew what he was going to pick. But I think the worry now is that the Republican Party has gone along with him. They've become Trumpified, so to speak. And I'm extremely nervous that going into 2022 and indeed 2024, whether Trump is involved in those elections or not, that the claims that he's been making about falsification of election results, again, which are untrue, will lead to continued violence because a significant portion of his party, the Republican Party, falsely believes that elections are rigged in the United States. So if Democrats win them, I think we're set up for a political culture in which every time that happens, there is a risk of a January 6th style event or indeed something worse. The trends are very, very negative around American democracy.
So the argument about Trump might also be he won a Democratic election. Is that not a good enough argument for why Trump's seeking of power and achieving of power is legitimate?
Well, I think, you know, I write a lot in the book about why we are drawn to people who are clearly bad leaders. And I think there's a lot of psychological research to talk about how some of the cognitive biases we have in leadership selection are irrational. I mean, part of it is obvious, right, that politics has become entertainment. It's become amusing. It's become something related to negative polarization where Donald Trump annoys the right people. He upsets the liberal elite. Therefore, we want him. Or he's funny or he's interesting or he keeps us on our toes. That's not a right way to select a leader. It doesn't make sense for deciding who should govern the lives of 330 million people and affect world politics everywhere else on the planet. But on top of that, there's also lots of research that shows why people are drawn to these sort of strongman figures. In the past, when there was a threat, it made a lot of sense to turn to someone who was a strong man, basically a warrior. The question is not just, should we accept this? Of course we should if he wins an election in 2024. But we should also have a larger conversation about what's wrong with us. And I think that's the uncomfortable part of the book where I'm saying, you know, yes, there is a self-selection effect of power-hungry people. Yes, psychopaths are better at getting power. Yes, power corrupts. But also, we are drawn to corruptible people, and that's something we all need to think about as members of a democratic society.
Brian, let me ask you this. We have an election here in Australia in the next couple of months, federal election probably in May. Any observations about the Australian context?
Well, I think it's one of these instances in which, you know, you have to think carefully about the personality traits that go along with politicians and not just the political tribalism. You know, one of the things I lament in modern politics everywhere, and this includes Australia, is that we end up thinking so clearly in categories that we don't think about individuals. And, you know, I think a lot of us have a basic intuition about whether somebody is in politics for the right reasons or not, but that often gets obscured by partisanship. And I think, you know, one of the other aspects that when I've talked to Australians in the past and people around the world, that they often say to me is, why is it that, you know, the choices we have are just awful. And so my perspective on this is that, you know, it's not going to be fixed in the next couple months, but if you're somebody who is, you know, totally disgusted with the choices that are before you, it's to think about what can you do to get involved in local politics? How can you press your local political party to recruit people who eventually will become the national politicians and so on? Because this is a pipeline effect. You know, the people who volunteer or become prominent in local party politics are those who will eventually become prominent in national party politics, most likely. So, you know, I think there's a universality to this disgust about the choices that people face. And I think that the answer to that is not just to throw up our arms and say, well, that's the way it always is in politics. It's to think creatively about how we can redesign systems to attract and promote better people into positions of power. It's up to us to decide whether we are governed in democratic societies or not. And unfortunately, too many people around the planet, have not gotten the wake-up call that we are in a moment of democratic emergency and that we need to fight back against authoritarianism, because once you lose democracy, it is very, very difficult to rebuild.
Well, Associate Professor Brian Klass from University College London, author of Corruptible, Who Gets Power and How It Changes Us. Brian, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And there's a longer version of that interview at the PM webpage. That is PM for this Thursday. I'm Linda Mottram. Thank you for listening. As well as the webpage where you'll find all our stories and interviews, you can find us on the ABC Listen app or get the PM podcast. And another podcast is ABC News Daily in the morning with Samantha Hawley. Nick Grimm is in the PM chair for you tomorrow evening.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.